and welcome to Foothold America's U.S. Expansion Mini-Pod, Three Questions, One Voice. Today, I'm thrilled to welcome American technology lawyer Daniel Glaser. He's the managing partner of Wilson Sonsini's London office, which he founded in 2018. Daniel is a powerhouse in transatlantic tech law and business strategy. He's been a game changer for UK and European tech and life science companies looking to thrive in the US market. A couple of his notable accolades include being named the American lawyer's first ever Transatlantic Innovator of the Year. UK Tech News named him one of London's top international connectors. Daniel has advised hundreds of high-growth companies, facilitated deals worth billions, and served as U.S. counsel for recognizable multinationals Cadbury, De Beers, and Virgin Media. Today, he'll share his insights on U.S. expansion, fundraising, mergers, and IPOs. All righty, let's get started with our three questions, hearing one voice, Mr. Daniel Glaser. How would you prioritize and order the various activities that founders need to do to prepare themselves for U.S. VC funding? And in this case, let's say they are they're looking at Series A. What would you say they need to do?
So the very first thing is to think about what type of investor are you looking for? Right? Is that, you know, investors are not homogenous, they're not monolithic. And not only do different investors look at different stages of companies, look at different sizes of companies, look at different sectors of companies, mm-hmm. but different funds have different return expectations. Mm. Right. And that is very, very important, because if you get mismatched expectations between what the founders and management want to do with the business and what the incoming VCs want to do with the business, that leads to substantial friction going forward. And in a worst case scenario, could lead, let's say, to the founders, the management team exiting the business. The way that I often kind of summarize it is for founders in the UK and Europe is I tell them you want to put the right fuel into the engine, right? To belabor the obvious, the fuel being the money, the engine being the company, right? Mm-hmm. But what you don't want is some sort of mismatch where you end up at a board meeting a year down the road, and let's say an M&A offer comes in to buy the company, and the founding team says, this sounds like a great deal. I'd like to take this. And the VC says, no, I was investing here because of a long-term potential multi-unicorn upside. Why are we selling out so early? And the founding team's thinking, but no, this is what I was always hoping for.
Oh, I see. Okay. Right? So essentially, like, they've got to alter their expectations in coordination with the VC, not just at the time when the deal is being done, but for all of the opportunities that come down the road afterwards. Is that
right? So
accurate?
An important question to answer when talking to a VC, or certainly before taking money from the VC, is what does good look like in terms of a return mm-hmm. to the VC? And does that align with what good looks like to the company? Mm-hmm. I mean, I remember a couple of years ago joining a group of UK companies in the Bay Area and had a discussion with a Bay Area fund that explained that, you know, their goal was to find companies that could return the funder more, mm-hmm. right? And given that they take typically 10-15% when they invest, right, you know, they were looking for companies that could be, you know, $1 billion, $2 billion plus exits. And then the question, of course, put to the companies was, well, how many of you really, you know, are that's what you're willing to commit to, mm-hmm. right? Is building a business that during the life cycle of the fund has the potential to have a multi-unicorn outcome without selling necessarily in advance for a smaller amount.
Right. That makes perfect sense. So when it comes to that, so we've got expectations we need to understand on both sides. Who's driving the bus? Is the company finding the VC that is going to fit them, or Are they going to have some ability to influence the VC, or do you find it the other way around? VC has the fuel, as you've said, and the company is going to have to go, this isn't what we imagined, but we've got to adjust. So what do you see out there when it comes to matching these expectations?
Yeah, I mean, usually different funds have, you know, their own personal investment thesis, mm-hmm. right? That their sweet spot, as it were, is going to be a particular size, particular stage, particular sector, particular return profile of company, right? And while there may be exceptions on the margins, right, where maybe they go outside of that for particularly unique and interesting opportunities, for the most part, the goal going in is that they're going to stick to the investment thesis. That's certainly the way that they've pitched it to the LPs that they've raised from.
Yeah, got it. Okay.
And it's much more likely that the company is going to have to find the right VC than it is that the VC is going to change what their investment thesis is.
Okay, we do understand who's driving this bus, don't we? Right. And that makes perfect sense.
But it's not, you know, it's certainly it's not in any sort of rigid or negative sense. It's simply,
sure.
You know, I like to think of it this way, like, you know, I'm running a company and it, you know, it is a B2B SaaS company growing 150% year on year and you know, with 50% revenues in the US and 50% revenues in the UK and Europe. And okay, so that's great. Let's go out and find the VCs that invest in companies with that profile. And it's probably not going to include ones that only invest in medical devices, right?
Right.
And you're not going to expect the medical device VC to change their investment profile to invest in the B2B SaaS company.
Right. Absolutely. It makes perfect sense when you say it like that.
and so the key is the research, you know, up front. So you don't waste your time and burn goodwill, and especially don't burn potential warm introductions that you might get from your network mm-hmm. into VCs that aren't a great fit for you.
Right. And you can, I mean, they're, at least in my experience, and you're looking at the VCs, they're fairly open in terms of communicating what it is they're looking for. So if you do your homework, you should be able to at least, you know, get a part of the way there to go, oh, this is going to be a good fit and this isn't.
Yeah, some will actually put their investment thesis on their website. Many don't, right? So I just want to say that up front. But especially in today's world where, you know, you can use LinkedIn to figure out, you know, who do I know first or second connection at their portfolio companies
right.
for a particular fund. It's very straightforward to network your way into the fund, into the portfolio, if not into the fund itself, mm-hmm. to just simply ask the question. Or to just ask in the ecosystem, hey, has anybody raised from, you know, Acme Fund before? Mm-hmm. And apologies if there is actually an Acme Fund. I just made that up. Right? But you know, is anybody familiar with what their investment thesis is? This right. is the sort of thing that in a well-functioning tech ecosystem, and certainly a mature tech ecosystem like a London, like a Paris, like a New York, like a Bay Area, you should be able to get the answers to these things
right.
relatively readily. It's certainly for the top funds.
Okay, great. That makes perfect sense. And so before we move on to our next question, because that was great information about setting expectations and making sure you find the right one, what are some of the other things, just briefly, that a company should do to make sure they're ready for this approach, other than this homework you've just mentioned, understand the VC in there and what they're looking for?
Yeah, so step one, figure out who the right types of VC are that you're looking mm-hmm. for. Okay. Step number two is going to be, okay, how am I as a company going to get into these investors, right? And the earlier stage that you are, the less likely it is that you're going to use, let's say, a corporate finance advisor, like a commission-based intermediary. You see a little bit more of that at the slightly later stages. The earlier stages, you see a little bit less of that. And you want to think through, if you're not going to use a corporate finance advisor, how are you going to leverage your network to get the so-called warm introduction to the extent that that is necessary. And it may be necessary. And you know, it's probably worth speaking a little bit on that, is that, you know, the value of the warm introduction. I'll tell you a bit of an anecdote that I remember speaking with a Silicon Valley investor some years ago, who said, you know, we see 50,000 deals a year and we invest in 50. Right. And how do we get from 50,000 to 50? Well, you know, if I don't recognize the name of the sender in the inbox, you know, I'm much more likely to just hit delete. But if it's somebody who is willing to put a little bit of their personal capital on the personal brand on the line, someone who I trust and will vouch for this company, well, that makes it that much more likely that I'm going to open the email.
And
give it some real thought that maybe there's something there I should be paying attention to. Okay. That, for better or for worse, and I don't want to take a position on that, because there is some better and there is some worse about that. Right? But for better or for worse, that is the value of the warm intro, is that it makes it easier for a VC that has to move fast and make quick decisions to make it more likely that they will make a quick decision in your favor relative to reaching out with a cold introduction on your own, right?
Right.
And I'm not saying that this is universally true, but this is certainly directionally true.
But that's great feedback, because I think there are plenty of organizations where it's just not clear. And I've heard you present many, many times on funding, and sometimes the conversation goes on how U.S. law firms are different, things like this. But I think this basic, you know, how to manage to work with VCs is really, really helpful. So anything else you want to add before we go on to question number two?
Yeah, the one other thing I'll add in terms of preparing, right, is that, so once that you've thought through the types of funds that you're looking for, and then thinking through how you're going to get to them, think about what you are going to put in front of them, in terms of what your either your pitch deck or your executive summary is going to look like, and what your cover email is going to look like.
Right.
There's a couple of bits of advice I always give. The first is actually a very common piece of advice that I give it in a slightly different context, which is that you never get a second chance to make a good first impression.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, your cover email, your pitch deck, your executive summary is not something that you should be throwing together overnight because, oh, you have an opportunity to meet VCs, so let me just throw together a pitch deck overnight and get it out.
Right.
Look, maybe you are just a genius marketer and can put together, you know, a world-class pitch deck in 24 hours, in which case, my hat's off, right?
Yeah, of course, it's something that needs to be massaged over time. You get some feedback from people. And so that is very practical advice. So you're going to make sure that you're aligned with your VC, figure out how you're going to get in front of them, and be prepared with your materials once you get in there. So it sounds like do your homework. So let's go on to question number two. And I've written this in a way that you're probably going to want to be quite diplomatic about it, because I'm going to ask you to share some things that you see that make you go, oh, goodness. So when you're meeting with potential clients, they're looking for representation. They're going to be wanting to get some funding. What are the telltale signs for you that this company is not ready? Because, and just before I let you answer that, you do a magnificent job of talking to people in the very, very early stages. So I know lots of people are coming to you and wanting to hear what you have to say. So what are those, let's just give it to our listeners. What are those things where you go, whoa, not ready for prime time?
So our particular focus, at least, you know, based in our London office, working with companies coming out of the UK and Europe, is on helping companies through their US life cycle, right? Launch, scale, raise venture capital, and then exit through M&A or IPO in the United States. And over time, we've seen you know, examples of when companies are and are not ready for each of those stages. And by having seen enough of those companies and had enough of those conversations, we can pattern match a bit, right? I'm not taking an extreme example. If someone comes to us and says, I'd like to have a discussion about, listing on the NASDAQ as a B2B SaaS company in the next 6 months, and we start the conversation, and it turns out that they've got, a million ARR, that's probably not a great candidate to be listing on the NASDAQ in the next 6 months.
So you'll say, go away, build your annual recurring friend. No, of course you'd never say that.
I'd say go away in that way, but...
See, I'm an American. I know you're dual now, but an American at heart. So those words just came out of my mouth. Go away. You would never say that. You've been in London far too long to say something quite that crass. But you would say you need to build your annual recurring revenue.
But at each stage of that U.S. life cycle, you can sort of, you can sort of tell, companies that more likely are or are not ready. So for example, if a company comes to us and says, I'm looking to, set up a whole U.S. structure, like a U.S. subsidiary and set up the bank account and the whole, and get the tax advice and the whole thing to set up a structure in the U.S.
And hire people and use a PEO, right?
Right. And the whole
there
thing.
There you go. There you go.
Well, actually, I was going to say before you even hire. Right.
Yeah.
If they come to us and say, I want to set up this whole structure, and then I ask them, well, how many employees are you hiring? And the answer is, we're not hiring for another couple of years. Then my answer actually is, you don't need the structure.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. Yeah.
Although the next stage, to what you were saying is that if they come to us and say, right, so the plan is to hire, three employees in New York, like a head of sales, which is a very highly paid position in New York City, right? Head of sales and two other senior salespeople. And I say, what are your annual revenues? Like, we're about 100,000 ARR. And I'm like, okay, how much have you raised? Like, well, we've raised, $500,000 from angels. And I'm like, you're not going to hire these people in New York. Yeah. You don't have the revenue sources to pay these people.
Right.
So it's that kind of discussions of sort of, and not taking it face value, but acting like a bit of a coach, right?
Yeah,
like
we're not
trying to be negative, but what we are trying to do is that explain to companies when you're building a startup, every day is a race, right? Between building a long-term, successful, sustainable business and running out of runway, right? Yeah. And you want to be thoughtful and intentional about how you spend your time and your limited resources.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's the same on our end. You can see the things that... that are typically in place. And actually, I find it quite satisfying if a company comes to us, they're just not there yet. And then a couple years later, they go, we're back. And you see the progress they've made. And then you go, now you've got those things in place. So I'm sure you deal with that a lot. And it's, at least for me, it's one of the very satisfying things about working with international companies and that they've got these aspirations for the U.S. So that's great. Anything else you want to add in terms of, we talked about the financial aspect of sort of being ready. What are some of the other areas where you think, here's somebody that's too early on and my coaching for them is going to be, to get back and do some other work. What are the other telltale signs?
So I think that the U.S. justifiably is a very attractive destination for UK European tech and life sciences companies. The capital markets and the commercial markets there are tremendous, right? But sometimes I'll talk to companies who say, I want to go to the U.S. and I'll push a bit and they're not really able to articulate what they're trying to accomplish in the United States.
Yeah.
Right? And as I always tell companies, you need to first determine what does success look like for you in the U.S. and then reverse engineer it from there.
Exactly. Start with the end in mind.
Right. Yeah. Perfect. If the goal is, and I'll go back to the hypothetical of being a B2B SaaS company, if the goal is we are a UK-based B2B SaaS company, we intend to always be a UK-based B2B SaaS company, but we think that there is a revenue opportunity in the United States where we think we can build up to a few million ARR each year out of the US, that is a very different go-to-market strategy that Absolutely. You're going to execute on than if you decide that, you know, we have a very specific proposition that requires US VCs to back, mm-hmm. and we want to optimize the product offering for the US market day one. And our long-term goal is we want to win the US, we want to win the market in the US in our sector. That go-to-market strategy is completely different.
Exactly. Exactly. Right?
I often hear companies and sort of ecosystem discussions talk about UK and European companies being successful in the United States. And my first question is always, well how are we defining success? Yeah, right. You know, at the one end of the spectrum, is success IPOing as a venture-backed scale-up in the United States? That's one end of the spectrum. And then being a successful public company after that. Another end of the spectrum is, you know, you end up making a small profit from your US operations, right? Is that successful or unsuccessful?
Yeah, no, it's brilliant. Those are just the fundamental questions that we see that all the time too. You're expanding to the US. Well, gosh, the US is huge. And what does that mean exactly in terms of industry and geography and all of those things. So makes perfect sense. So great to start with US as an aspiration, but you've got to drill down and understand why are we doing this. So great.
And the reason may change over time, right? That the company that starts off thinking, I am a UK-based B2B SaaS company and will always be a UK-based B2B SaaS company, and I just want to make the US one revenue source out of many, mm-hmm. might raise a round or two of funding, might get real product market fit in the US, find that it's up to 50 million ARR in the US, and has a very different idea of what's
exactly. You're like, maybe we need to refocus here. Absolutely.
Right. So you have to be flexible, mm-hmm. but adaptable, but you should have a working straw man model of what you're aiming yes. for at all times.
Makes perfect sense. Great. I'm going to go to question number three, and I'll ask you not to be so humble because I know that you and Wilson Sonsini have been just part of many, many, many deals of some of them just so notable and amazing. But when you're a founder, we're not talking just starting out, but you've got some momentum and you're looking for your legal representation when it comes to, you know, going to the US, your US representation. And you're evaluating, hey, am I going to Wilson Sonsini? Am I going here? What are the things that founders should keep in mind when they're looking for their US legal representation?
So to answer that for a UK and European audience, I need to first explain the difference between working with lawyers in the United States and working with lawyers in the UK and Europe, which is a little bit like football and football. That if you're in the UK and Europe, football is a ball that you kick. And in the United States, although you may sometimes kick it, it is primarily a ball that you throw.
Right.
And it's tricky because it's called the same thing, football and football, lawyer and lawyer. But the roles are often very, very different. And I'm going to speak to for a second as to why the difference is there and how it impacts your business, because this is not, in my experience, obvious to UK and European companies going to the US. And for that matter, it's not obvious to Americans going to the UK and Europe. That in much of the rest of the world, and particularly in the UK and Europe, Joanne, if you and I were at respective companies and we had a business dispute and we go to court, right? And you win, I pay most or all of your legal fees. It's a loser pays environment. In fact, in American law schools, it's referred to as the English rule, interestingly enough. in a loser pays environment, that depresses the level of litigation activity.
Yes.
Because nobody wants to go double or nothing on legal fees unless you are highly certain that you are going that there's going to be a successful outcome. Right. And you statistically see that, that there's the sheer volume of litigation you don't see in the UK and Europe like you do in the United States. Exactly. You don't see the volume of threatened claims like you do in the United States.
Right.
And in an environment where litigation is sort of a non-risk, right? From a rightly or wrongly, especially from a startup's standpoint, where they've got massive demands, massive competing demands on their money and their time and limited resources of, you know, of limited quantities of both, legal ends up being a much lower priority because the downside risk of getting it wrong is not that great, relatively speaking.
Right. Absolutely. Right?
So companies tend to have a little bit more of a transactional approach where legal is often seen as a technical service that they need performed for them. And I always say it's interesting, it's actually built into the language in the UK. The language of hiring counsel in the US is the verb is to instruct. It's to instruct a lawyer. And it's funny because I had a Silicon Valley colleague of mine come over to the UK some months ago, and company said, "We're thinking about instructing you." And his response was, "I haven't been, that's a funny one. I haven't been instructed since I was 6 years old and got in trouble with my mother."
Right.
And to an American ear, that phrase "instruct a lawyer" is jarring. It's like if someone from Europe came to the United States and went to a soccer game and said, "This is quite the football match."
Right.
The people around them, it would sound jarring.
Yeah, and that's the difference
between saying "instruct a lawyer" and the American, which is to take advice of counsel.
Right.
In other words, in the US, your lawyers are advising you, whereas in the UK, you're instructing the lawyers.
Yes, absolutely. And you've described in the past the role that your legal representation plays on boards, and I think this is just one example of the things that you talk with your clients about, or the presentations you're doing, or the ecosystems you work in, where you're letting folks know, just understanding the role of the lawyer in the US is vastly different. So it's a great education for folks outside of the US to get. So that's great.
Because in the US, you know, everything I just described about the litigation system, you know, on the other side of the Atlantic, US is different. Right. Because in the US, of course, Joanne, if you and I are at a company, or each your respective companies, and we go to court and you win, you generally, with limited exceptions, but generally pay your own legal fees. Right. Which means that, you know, if I am an IP owner and I'm looking for you to take a license, if I'm a disgruntled employee and I want to get some sort of severance payment from you, if I'm a commercial counterparty looking to get out of a contract, if I am a business competitor and looking to challenge you in the market, then I, as a company, can use litigation claims and threats as a business negotiation tool.
Absolutely.
Because when I leverage that tool, I then put you in a position where you've got two choices. You can go to court and you beat me, but now you're out, you know, some large number of legal fees that you're not getting reimbursed for.
Sure.
Or you settle on my terms, which also is suboptimal.
Exactly.
And so how do you deal with that? And by the way, as an aside, that's usually when I explain this to UK and European companies, that they switch from irrational exuberance about America to irrational despair about America. But of course, like the right answer is in between, which is that, yes, it's a massive commercial and capital market, but the way you do business there is a little bit different, right?
Right.
And one of the differences is, and why you take advice of counsel rather than instruct a lawyer, is that instead of, and you don't want to pick door number one, litigation, door number two, you know, unfavorable settlement. Door number three is you take problem avoidance advice, so that you stay out of door number one and door number two.
Sure. Bingo. Yes. Don't wait. Don't wait. Right. And just, yeah, get all your ducks in a row in advance.
So American lawyers answer one core question for startups that's a little bit unusual, I think, from the perspective of a UK or European company, which is the question that lawyers are typically answering for startups is, how does my startup achieve its business goals while managing risk? Right? Not eliminating risk. You generally cannot, especially as a disruptive startup, you can't really eliminate risk. But how do you run the business so that you're optimizing for the potential commercial outcomes while appropriately managing risk? And what that means is that the lawyers all have a business hat, right? Because you can't just advise on risk. You have to have the business considerations.
Right.
But the business people in the U.S. generally have a pretty good understanding of legal dynamics, right? Because they know that if they completely ignore
it's not just law. Yeah, right. Sure.
And no, so that leads to a sort of a blended business commercial legal relationship between the lawyers and the startups. And the way that manifests itself is not just by doing technical legal work, but by being in attendance at boards and advising, being an advisor to the board, helping with, let's say, connections between commercial counterparties, between investors in the network, right? Doing everything that we can to be helpful to build the business and then be supportive as a legal advisor.
That's excellent. I really want to ask you more questions, but I know this is a mini podcast, so this is great. Maybe we'll have to have you come back. Even though we're three questions, one voice, I have sort of the bonus question for this season, and it's about how you manage culture across borders. So you're the founder of the London office for Wilson Sonsini, and I know you've got colleagues that have their education, their law certifications from different countries. How do you find how do you and how does Wilson Sonsini manage the cultural differences in your employee group on one side of the pond and the other? So some of the things like making your policies fair or equitable, and I'm sure you've got quite a few Americans working for you in London and vice versa. So what are some of the things, taking off your, I'm advising founders, but as a business owner and manager, a people manager, how do you manage to keep the cultural balance on both sides of the ocean?
So I'll answer that both in sort of a micro, which is me personally or me individually, and then maybe a macro, which is the office within the overall firm. On an individual basis, I spent many years as an American, as a New York expat, technically New Jersey for all you New Yorkers out there. Right. Bridge and tunnel, as they say.
Gosh, it's, yeah, no, I understand.
many years spending time getting to understand the UK market, the UK culture. I did naturalize almost 2 years ago now, so I am officially both a Brit and an American. Right. But I think what that means is that I've tried to go to great lengths to understand how the other side lives, the other half lives, as they say. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right? And so I try to constantly be putting myself in the shoes of the other side to understand how different dynamics, how different discussions, how words may be interpreted differently from the other side of the Atlantic. I try to keep in my mind that football and football mean different things simultaneously.
Right, right.
Right. And switch back and forth constantly. And, it took a long time to get to that point, and it'll always be a journey. I'm not going to say that, I always get it right. But I have spent a lot of time and spent a lot of time thinking through, how can I be a better translator, mm-hmm. For the the two sides of the Atlantic, right? When I'm like, when I talk to, you know, American investors who are looking at, you know, UK companies, you know, I feel that I can convey to them what the company is thinking, having spent a lot of time here, and vice versa, right? When I'm talking to a UK company, I can explain, look, this is the perspective you might be used to when building a business in the UK, or talking to investors in the UK, or let's say, you know, selling to a UK buyer, but this is the way that Americans are going to view it, and hopefully describing it in a way that will resonate.
Right.
So on a personal level, that's what I do is sort of maintain, as you can see by my background, both literally and figuratively.
It's a background, but it's there, you know, it sort of reflects your philosophy, which is I'm going to try and understand the other and make things work as well as possible. So, and you wanted to, add something from the Wilson Sonsini perspective.
And on a macro level, I think we are engaged in quite the experiment, which is that we have about roughly half the office are expat Americans in London, and half the office are native English solicitors. And we run it quite intentionally as a blended blended UK US team. That really is what we like to think is our USP, right? Is that we're offering a blended British American team in London to help companies through that US life cycle, as opposed to a London office that is all locally hired and an American office that is all locally hired, which is fine. But when our goal is specifically to translate, we find that we can be effective translators when we have kind of everybody together under one roof. Now that comes with its challenges, right? but I also do find that the relationship with the U.S. offices is strong and robust and enduring because so many of us came from the U.S. offices.
Right. Right? And, so it's easy for you to translate for your colleagues.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly. Because what we have in London is partially from London and partially from the U.S., it allows us to operate as an integrated whole, both internally and across the Atlantic, in a fairly unique way.
Right. And one of the things I think that is so strong about the London office is that you are very focused. You know exactly what it is you're doing. You're not trying to be all things to all people. And so when you are a British lawyer joining Wilson Sonsini in London, you know what you're getting. You know you're a part of a very singularly focused firm. And I think that's, as an outsider, I think that's one of your strengths. I recall an early conversation with you, and I was sort of thinking, just sort of generalized questions, but I had sort of Foothold America in mind, and you were like, we do this, we're tech, It's, I think, served you very well. You've had great success, and you've made a wonderful ecosystem. So I'm so pleased that you have spent some time today to share with our audience some of the experiences you've had. And I'm sure you've given some people, some founders in UK and Europe, some ideas about that they need to think through and dive into before they come talk to you. But we'll put your contact information in the comments, and especially connecting to the U.S. practice, U.S. expansion practice part of your website, so that people can reach you. Is there anything else you would like to tell our listeners to be considering, the things that you have coming up, anything like that?
Just to highlight one thing, we've put on the Medium website a 60 question, frequently FAQ, right? Mm-hmm. Of following, you know, many conversations that we've had with UK and European founders over the years, that we've kind of distilled it down into about 60 or so of the most common questions that we get, and then linked to the answers. And we've open sourced that, right? That's available to everybody, and we find that that's a good starting point as you're thinking through what's my US strategy going to be.
I'm sure you had those questions. They are frequently asked because you've answered them. Someone comes to talk to you and you go, oh, that's question number 37 for sure. I've answered that about 9,000 times over the years. So that sounds like a great resource. So we'll make sure that we put that link in the comments too. So thank you so much for being a part of the US Expansion Mini Pod. 3 questions, 1 voice. I'm delighted that you've agreed to spend your time with us and share your expertise.
Thanks so much, Joanne.
Thank you for joining us for this insightful episode featuring Daniel Glaser, the founding partner of Wilson Sonsini's London office. Thank you, Daniel, for sharing your expertise in guiding technology and life science companies through their U.S. expansion journey. If you enjoyed today's conversation, subscribe to U.S. Expansion Minipod on your favorite platform. Published on the first and third Wednesdays of every month, you'll find engaging U.S. expansion discussions with industry leaders and innovators. Don't forget to share this episode with your network and leave us a review. We love hearing your feedback. For more information on Daniel Glaser and his work at Wilson Sonsini, you'll find his contact information and a link to their U.S. expansion practice in the comments. This has been Joanne Farquharson, President and CEO of Foothold America, and that wraps up our 3 questions for today. Until next time, keep expanding your horizons.